Right. In the last extensive talk of the day, we hear from Matt Pusey about contextuality. Go ahead.
Okay, so I want to talk about something that's kind of a new direction for me, but it's something other people have been thinking about for a few years now, I guess. And that's trying to, in a rigorous way, classify which quantum phenomena are the really weird things unique to quantum mechanics, and which are the quantum phenomena where, if you think about it, you can actually come up with a convincing classical explanation. And by quantum phenomena, I mean things like quantum teleportation, quantum tunneling, the existence of quantum speed-up for computational problems, all these kinds of things. So why is it worth attempting this kind of classification? One reason is that these kind of phenomena are the sort of raw material for all kinds of quantum foundational activity. So if you're trying to distill quantum theory into some physical principles that you're going to derive the formalism from, or if you're wanting to do experiments that test what you think are the most sort of interesting aspects of quantum theory, all these kind of things, you know, the quantum phenomena are your starting point, and so it's good to have some quality control on that, where you make sure that the things you're starting with are really the interesting things that you should be focusing on. And another reason is that there's a very good chance that it will just deepen your understanding of the phenomenon. So you start with your phenomenon, and you try and work out whether it really is bizarre or whether you can come up with a classical explanation, and you kind of win either way. So if you find that some classical explanation or some classical analog to the phenomenon, then you've opened up a connection between this topic in quantum theory and something, you know, some other topic. And, you know, these kind of connections have a tendency to shed light on both areas. And if you, on the other hand, decide that it really is a weird phenomenon, then that can be a starting point to think about how you could actually put that to use. So it really wasn't until Bell explained what was weird about quantum correlations that people really started thinking about how to use them. And indeed, that result led directly to something called device-independent key distribution. So that's the basic idea. But I said that this was to be a rigorous classification, right? All those things I talked about were kind of methodological. So you might say, well, you know, we don't need a rigorous notion of theoretical elegance. You just know it when you see it. So why do I think that quantum weirdness needs a rigorous definition? One reason is that it's just quite easy to miss things. Okay, so you might look at some quantum phenomena, and the way it looks in the quantum formalism, it might look kind of bizarre. You might say, well, I don't see how that could happen classically. But then you might sit down and actually try and prove that it can't happen classically, and realize that, oh, there's something I'm missing here. Actually, you know, here's a good classical explanation for it. And another reason is that it forces you to be explicit about what your assumptions are. So different people think about quantum theory in different ways. They have different intuitions. And so you can sometimes get into a situation where two people think they're arguing about what the answer to something is, but they're actually arguing about the question. And so if you do things formally, you're actually forced to list, well, you know, here are the things I'm assuming, you know, not just my kind of background assumptions, but also exactly which aspects of the quantum phenomena I think are the interesting ones. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that this is a worthwhile thing to do. And so now I'm just going to go through quickly three things that you might try and use as your rigorous definition of what it means for something to be weird. So the first one is just to say, I'm going to call something weird if it can't occur only using operators in quantum mechanics that are all diagonal in the same basis. So a simple example of such a phenomenon is the phenomenon of incompatible measurements. Okay, there are pairs of measurements in quantum theory where you have to choose either to do one measurement or the other. You can't do both. And that's something that wouldn't happen if both of your measurements were diagonal in the same basis. So that's the thing that's impossible. And so you could say that that's some notion of this being a weird phenomenon. Another one, which is the one I'm going to focus on, is that you can say something is weird if it's incompatible with something called a non-contextual ontological model. And the simplest example of that is if you take a qubit and think about preparing, like imagine it's a spin half particle, think about preparing spin up, spin down, left or right, and then think about measuring in one of these two diagonal bases. Well, there's certain correlations between which state you prepare and the results of your measurements. And what you might try and do is explain those correlations by saying, in between the preparation and the measurement is some variable that we call an ontic state, lambda. That on its own turns out not to put any constraints. But the assumption of non-contextuality says that, in this case, tossing a coin and with 50% probability implementing 0, 50% probability implementing 1, turns out to prepare the system in a way that's operationally equivalent to with 50% probability preparing minus and 50% probability plus. And the assumption of non-contextuality says that your ontological model has to do justice to that feature, in that the same mixture of things in your ontological model really is the same. So the reason why those two different procedures give you something that's operationally the same is because they give you something that really is the same in your ontological model. Don't worry if you didn't get that, I'm going to go back to it. Yeah? No, it's a contextual ontological model. I think it's weird, but we can go back to that. Okay, and my third candidate is Bell's theorem, which I mentioned earlier. The simplest example of that is you can prepare some two-qubit entangled state, such as this one, and then you give one qubit to Alice, who's going to choose between measuring in these two directions, and another qubit to Bob, who's going to choose between these two measurements. Quantum mechanics tells you what the probabilities of their measurement outcomes are going to be. And that turns out to be incompatible with the most natural explanation of those probabilities, which is that they're due to a common cause. Okay, that when you prepare your entangled state, you get some lambda, and then that Alice's system, Alice's measurement device, and Bob's measurement device just separately have to take that lambda and give some outcome. So these quantum correlations occur even if the measurements are done at space-like separation. So it's natural to think that there can't be any causal connection between Alice and Bob's measurement devices. Okay, and these three things form a hierarchy in that proofs of incompatibility with Bell local models are proofs of contextuality, and proofs of contextuality require operators that aren't diagonal in the same basis. So given that, why have I gone for the middle one? In case I slip into it later, some jargon for the incompatibility with diagonal operators would be to say that the phenomenon uses coherence. Jargon for incompatibility with non-contextual models would be that it's contextual. And an even more misleading jargon for incompatibility with Bell local models is non-locality. So the first thing you could use to compare them is to say, well, what's the shock value of realizing that your phenomenon is incompatible with this thing? If it's not really that surprising to have something that's incompatible with your principle, then it's not a very good criterion of weirdness, right? We want our weirdness to be weird. And so this is how I would rate these three candidates. This is not an untrivial thing, saying that things that are in this category but not in these other categories aren't that shocking. That's kind of, in hindsight, with some of the lessons we've learned from thinking about quantum theory as a theory of information. Another thing you might ask is, well, how common are phenomena that violate these principles? As you'd kind of expect, the more shocking the thing is, the harder it is to find examples of it. The next two, I would say, are really the key criteria. The first is, if you think something's weird, you really should be able to explain why it's weird without making reference to the quantum formalism. And the first candidate doesn't do that. It was explicitly stated in terms of quantum mechanics. Whereas the other two, if you do them carefully, they make no reference to quantum theory at all. And the other is, there's this whole host of quantum phenomena that you might want to classify. We really need a criteria that's going to be applicable to as many of those as possible. The first two do pretty well at that. The final one, Bell locality, that's really only applicable when you've got this situation where you're doing space-like separated measurements on an entangled state. And there are just lots of quantum phenomena that don't really fit into that picture. So mostly because of these last two reasons, I think non-contextuality is the best principle to use. Okay. So let me just try and explain again exactly what I mean by non-contextuality. The basic thinking is just that if you're trying to create an explanation for some quantum phenomena, it's better if it doesn't make distinctions that don't have a difference, or to put it in a more fancy way, it should satisfy the identity of indiscernibles. In particular, if your explanation is in terms of an ontological model, then there shouldn't be distinctions in that model that don't make a difference to the operational predictions. Or to put it the other way, you should have the ontological identity of operational indiscernibles. So what does that mean? Here is a more general equation for what an ontological model looks like. So I'm imagining that you're preparing some density operator rho, and then you're measuring some PAVM that has outcome E. So quantum mechanics tells you what this probability is. And then we're trying to explain that using an ontological model where we've got this lambda that screens off the preparation from the measurement. And in general, so you prepare your system in some quantum state rho, and in the ontological model, that means you're preparing some lambda. And there's no reason why that, in principle, can depend on all sorts of other things other than the density operator that you're preparing. And I'm lumping all of those things into what I'm calling the context of that preparation. And the same thing could apply to the measurement. But that goes against this principle of non-contextuality. So in a non-contextual ontological model, as defined in this paper, we don't allow any of those dependencies. So when you prepare a system, the only thing that can matter for working out its ontic state is the density operator. And when you measure it, the only thing that can matter is what you're measuring according to quantum mechanics. So what an example of these contexts that I'm talking about is that there can be two different ways to prepare the same density operator by mixing pure states. So this is like the example I gave at the start. So it could be that if I choose amongst these psi i's with probability pi's, or I choose amongst these phi j's with probability qj, I end up with the same density operator. And that means that if I put that whole choice of a random pure state into a box and just let the quantum system come out, and you're only allowed to make measurements on the quantum system, you can't determine whether what's in the box is the mechanism that does this or this. In our ontological model, this preparation is going to just be the obvious thing. It's going to be whatever lambda you get from preparing psi I with probability pi. Okay? And likewise for the other preparation. And so you can think of either doing this and this as being two different contexts for preparing rho, and non-contextuality says that there can't be any difference between those two things. And I would argue that non-contextuality is a necessary condition for your ontological model to be offering you a plausible explanation of some quantum phenomena. Apparently not all of you agree with that. But I would even like to go a bit further and say that if your ontological model is non-contextual, that's also sufficient for it to be a plausible explanation, which is, on the face of it, kind of surprising. This is just one condition you might put on an ontological model, and you might think that it would just be kind of a whack-a-mole thing. You'd say, oh, I don't like that contextuality, I'm going to impose non-contextuality, and then you'd see there's something else implausible about your model, you'd impose some other condition to get rid of that, and then you'd realize that there's some other implausibility. But in my experience, it seems like if the model's non-contextual, it generally makes a lot of sense. Okay, so now let me talk about how people have tried to use this principle of contextuality to start classifying some quantum phenomena into the ones compatible with non-contextual ontological models, which we would say are the less weird ones, and the ones that are incompatible with non-contextual ontological model, which we're going to say those are the really weird things. And in some ways, this is kind of a reversal of the normal thing you do if you're proving a no-go theorem. So in the normal approach, you come up with your principle that you think your model should satisfy, non-contextuality, say. And then you just go looking through all of quantum mechanics until you find something that gives you a contradiction with that. But here, the idea is someone gives you a quantum phenomena and asks you, is that compatible with your principle? And so you just have to take the phenomena as it is. You can't go bring in a load of other irrelevant facts about quantum theory and see whether that on its own is enough to get a contradiction with your principle or not. And in reality, you might never quite reach that ideal. You might have to go back and say, well, actually, you know, isn't there something else about that phenomenon you could tell me, and then I'll be able to prove what I want to prove. So it's kind of a spectrum from, on the one hand, the traditional approach of just looking anywhere in quantum theory to get your contradiction, and on the other hand, the kind of ideal of someone just giving you your phenomena and you being able to say yes or no, whether it's weird or not. And so this is one of the early examples. It's about something called multiplexing, which is also called random access codes. It's basically the ability to encode two bits in a single qubit in such a way that if you randomly choose whether you want to access the first bit or the second bit, you can't access them perfectly, but you can access them. You have an 85% probability of getting it right. And it turns out that if there was a non-contextual ontological model for that game, then there'd only be a 75% probability of getting it right. The reason why this is kind of a bit far from that ideal is that although people had thought about random access codes before, they hadn't really been thinking about this exact version of them. So another quantum phenomena that it's interesting to think about is the speed up of quantum computers over classical ones. So you might think that's kind of a pointless thing to worry about. It's pretty obvious that being able to compute faster than any classical computer is a pretty weird thing. But What we're less sure about is what the source of that speed up is. If you look in your newspaper, it will probably tell you that it's because the quantum computer tries all of the possible answers at once. But turns out that that's really not a very good guide to what quantum computers can do. And if we come up with a better understanding of how they work, hopefully we'll be better at coming up with uses for quantum computers. So people have studied this question in one particular model of quantum computation, which is a measurement-based model, where before you've even decided what you want to compute, you prepare some big entangled state, and then you encode what computation you want to do by how you measure that state. And that already sounds like it's kind of going against our classical intuitions. Like, you would never try and encode any important decision in how you measure a classical system, like, oh, if I want to compute this thing, I'll measure its position. If I want to do this thing, I'll measure its momentum. Because after all, you could have just measured both things. You're not really making a meaningful decision there. And these results are basically making that intuition precise, although it turns out to be a surprisingly subtle thing to actually do properly. Another example, a more recent one, is that some guys at IQC have studied another model of quantum computation, which is where you're doing your error correction in such a way that there's certain gates that you can do quite easily, but they're not enough to build a whole quantum computer. And the way you get around that is you have some way of preparing special states that are called magic states that sort of promote your computer into a full universal quantum computer. And these guys found that those magic states, together with the operations that you can do easily on your quantum computer, are enough to construct proofs of contextuality. In odd prime dimension, which sort of left the most common case of qubits open. And there's been some partial results in that direction, although I still don't think it's fully understood. So, you know, where would I put these on my spectrum of, you know, traditional versus just taking the phenomenon as it is? They're pretty far over in the right direction, but they are taking models of quantum computation where the very nature of the model already sort of more clearly identifies what the quantum aspect is than is the case in the kind of standard circuit model of quantum computation. And so I think maybe the most interesting results in this area are still to come. Okay. So I now want to get towards something I've been thinking about, which is something called anomalous weak values. So I noticed when I was making this that this controversy has actually been going on since before I was born, which is a kind of surprising sounding title of this paper, how the result of a measurement of a component of the spin of a spin half particle can turn out to be 100. I mean, something that should be plus or minus one being 100 is certainly pretty surprising, but obviously there's a lot of small print behind that claim. And so pretty much since this paper has come out, people have been, you know, coming up with various purported explanations for this phenomenon, you know, arguing about whether it really captures the essence of it, and so on. And most recently, these two guys, one of which is now at PI, published a paper where they argued that even just a classical coin could exhibit the same feature of anomalous weak values, and that therefore it's really not a good example of quantum weirdness. So what are anomalous weak values? To explain that, I need to explain weak measurements. To explain that, I should start with strong measurements. So a strong measurement is just an ordinary projective measurement of the type you'd read about in your first quantum physics textbook. So here, I've got a qubit I'm preparing in a superposition of 0 and 1, and then I'm going to measure whether it's 0 or 1. And after I've done the measurement, if I get the plus 1 outcome, the state is going to collapse to 0, and if I get minus 1, it's going to collapse to 1. And now, what we do is kind of build a more elaborate model of what's going on there, using something called a pointer system, which is this like slightly steampunk idea that we do this, you know, high-tech quantum measurement, and then the result comes up on this gauge like this. But it just means any continuous variable system where the result of the measurement is being encoded. So we now think of the measurement as being done by taking our system and interacting it with this interaction with this pointer system. And we've prepared the pointer system in such a way that we've got a very good idea of what its position is. And this interaction is designed such that if the spin is up, then the pointer gets shifted to the right. And if it's down, it gets shifted to the left. So if we measure this superposition, then half the time the pointer is going to go to the left, half the time it's going to go to the right. And the new states are just like they were before. So far, this is just a more elaborate way of talking about the same thing. But when you look at it this way, what you can see is that not only is this interaction sort of copying the Z information from here and using it to generate position shifts over here, you can equally well think of it as performing a measurement on the momentum of the pointer system and using that to generate Z rotations on the system. And that's one way of thinking about where the disturbance comes from when you make a measurement. And now you might think, well, we can reduce the disturbance caused by this measurement if we just make sure that the system has as little momentum, the pointer system has as little momentum as possible. But by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the more certainty we have about the momentum, the less we have about the position. So we end up in a situation like this. Still does a perfectly good measurement. Nothing's really changed. Now if we reduce the spread in momentum even more, so increasing the spread in position, we start to get a situation where if the pointer pretty much stays where it is, that's kind of an ambiguous outcome. Okay, it doesn't really clearly fit into this peak, doesn't clearly fit into this one. And indeed, if you calculate what the state of the system is, given that the pointer stayed where it was, say, or was it zero, you'll find it's completely unaffected. But it's very unlikely to get one of these ambiguous outcomes. So on average, the state is disturbed just as much as it was in the strong measurement. But then we keep cranking and cranking. And eventually we get to a point where essentially all of our, any of the measuring, the results of looking at the pointer tell you very little about what the thing you're trying to measure. But on the other hand, even on average, the state is only disturbed from here to just being a tiny little bit mixed. So we've really gone a long way in that trade-off of reducing our disturbance at the cost of increasing our error. And then we add in something else, which is post-selection. So now I'm going to do this weak measurement procedure, but then I'm going to do a measurement in this direction, and I'm only going to count the cases where I get this outcome. So if we did that with a strong measurement, well, this post-selection is slightly more likely to occur if we get this outcome than this outcome. So we just get the same as the normal strong measurement, but just with a slight bias towards that outcome. But as we start to weaken the measurement, that effect becomes more and more pronounced. And remember, if I get an outcome way out here, the state of the system ends up here, and so it's much more likely to pass that pace selection. And so you end up with a situation where, given that the pace selection has happened, the average value of the pointer is, in this case, about 6, even though we're doing a measurement where it should be either plus or minus 1. And in case you can't quite get your head around that, it's a bit easier if, instead of plotting the probability of the pointer being in a certain position given that the pace selection happened, I'm just going to plot the probability of the pointer being in a certain position and the pace selection occurring. And that means I can also, in this gray here, just show the probability without thinking about the pace selection at all. And then you see this same weird peak that's out here, but you realize that at least part of the story is that you're pace selecting on something that in this case only happens about 2% of the time. And so this anomaly is just this tiny little subset of all your results. And so the weak value just turns out to be what the average value of the position, given the pace selection succeeded, is in the limit of an arbitrarily weak measurement. And it's given by this expression. So now that I've kind of gone through the quite convoluted story of how you calculate these things, you might see why there's been quite a lot of controversy about whether this really counts as an instance of quantum weirdness or not. And so after this title and this title, obviously the next one is anomalous weak values of proofs of contextuality, where what I do is show that actually whenever you have one of these anomalous weak values, i.e. You're measuring something that, say, should be plus or minus 1, and you get something that's outside of that range. When you take into account certain key properties of how weak measurements work, it's not compatible with these non-contextual ontological models I defined at the start. And so, for me at least, they are actually a good case of quantum weirdness. And I'll just very quickly go through how you prove that. Basically, it turns out that there's kind of three possible strategies your ontological model might use to reproduce this anomaly. And I'm going to use three applications of the principle of non-contextuality to show that each of them are impossible. And so the conclusion is that there is just no non-contextual explanation of the phenomenon. And they're all possibilities that people have discussed. So one possibility is just that the pace selection, like talking about preparing the system and post-selecting, really doesn't pick out a well-defined ensemble of systems. And so, for example, if you think that the ontic state is just the quantum state and nothing else, then there isn't, when you prepare some state, there isn't some subset of those systems that is destined to pass the post-selection. It's just a completely random thing. But it turns out that in a non-contextual model, projective measurements have to be represented deterministically. That's the standard result that you can see in this paper. So that first possibility is ruled out. The second possibility, and I think this is what a lot of people who work on weak values have in mind, is that the set of those systems that are compatible with how you prepared it and how you're going to post-select it somehow are predisposed, or there's some reality to them having these anomalous weak values. That again turns out to be incompatible with non-contextuality because of this operational equivalence. So time is going up now, so a quantum system's coming in here, giving a result x, and I'm saying that if you just look at the statistics of this x for any possible preparation, these two things are equivalent. One is doing the weak measurement and throwing away the system. The other is doing the normal strong measurement that just gives you the plus or minus one outcome, and then adding some Gaussian noise to that. Okay? And so, by the assumption of non-contextuality, the fact that these two things are equivalent operationally means they have to be equivalent in your ontological model. Okay? So, you can't have a system that's predisposed to give a weak measurement result of 10, because it just has to give either plus or minus 1, plus some random noise. And so the only option that leaves you is that in the cases where, through sheer fluke, you do get a result of 6, the system is disturbed in some way to increase the likelihood of the post-selection succeeding. But there's another operational equivalence, which is now you forget about the result of the weak measurement and just look at the channel that you get from that. And that turns out to be equivalent to, with very high probability, doing nothing at all to the system, and with very low probability, applying some channel that disturbs it. And that probability scales as about the square of the weakness parameter. Whereas it would need to scale linearly in order to do the work you're hoping to get it to do. And I think the nice thing about this example is these three possible things on the face of it don't have anything to do with operational equivalences, and so it's not clear what non-contextuality is going to do for you. But it turns out that there are ways of talking about them in terms of operational equivalences, and so you can get the non-contextuality to do the work and to rule out these nice explanations. Thank you.
Yep, coming.
So, for those last two things, can you explain in what sense the I mean, you have these two boxes that you're saying are operationally equivalent, but they don't seem operationally equivalent to me. I mean, in one case, you're doing post-selection, which means that the total probability of success of that box is less than 1. In the other one, there's no post-selection, right?
So you're talking about this equivalence or the...
Yeah, but it seemed like the third one also had a similar...
So I'm not talking about the entire scheme here. This box is just supposed to represent doing the weak measurement.
Oh, I see. So this is okay.
Okay, and I'm just saying, if you do the weak measurement and you just throw the system away, so you don't post select, you just trace out the system.
The ancilla.
No, the system you're measuring.
System you're measuring. Okay.
Yeah. So this is the system you would normally post select if you were doing the whole scheme. I'm saying instead, just think about just throwing it away. And that turns out to be equivalent to doing the strong measurement, but with noise.
Also, with throwing the system away. Because you did a strong measurement.
Yeah.
And so, okay, but in neither case can you actually then do a post-selection because you've thrown the system away?
No. So, you're testing operational equivalences that the things on the left are built from things that you do in the weak measurement scheme, but they're not the exact things that you do. And so, I'm counting those as like fair game in as being part of the whole phenomenon, right? In some sense, this is actually something that people complain about with weak measurements is that, oh, these things you're calling interesting are just measurement errors. And this is basically what they're getting at, I think. And that's one of the ingredients in this proof.
By the way, don't go away. We have two quick presentations just after the end of this.
Yep.
So I'm wondering if you could comment on experimental manifestations of this whole story, because in principle now there are systems which are very well controlled, where people do weak quantum measurements, right? Let's say superconducting qubits, cavities, and so on. Right. So, are you looking for some experimental tests?
So I think this does actually have interesting things to say about experimental tests, because if your plan is just to observe some anomalous weak value, it's not clear what the alternative hypothesis that your experiment is going to rule out is. Whereas what this proof tells you is that there's actually a very natural thing that your experiment could try and rule out, namely the existence of a non-contextual ontological model. And so this kind of gives you a null hypothesis if you want to do an experiment on weak values. And one of the things that you get from the proof is that there's actually a whole bunch of things that you need to check in order to falsify that hypothesis, other than just that the average result, you know, was outside the normal range. You have to check all of these equivalences as well. So I think it does have relevance to experiments, but there'll be much tougher experiments than the ones that have been done so far.
No more questions? Okay, let's thank Matt again.